Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's just 6 days until the election, and the candidates are making their fierce final appeals in key battleground states. Senator John Kerry roared through Iowa and Minnesota today. He'll be in Ohio and Wisconsin tomorrow. President George Bush was hard at work today in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. On Friday, the word is he'll be back in New Hampshire, his seventh visit to the Granite State this year. With the polls getting tighter and Election Day looming, we're taking stock of the candidates' final push for the battleground states and what it reveals about the unforgiving calculus of victory and loss on Tuesday. Tonight on Point, Bush, Kerry, and the final stretch fight for the presidency. We begin with two reporters on the campaign trail with the candidates tonight. Joining me now from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is Tim Grieve, senior writer for Salon.com, traveling with the Kerry campaign. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Pontiac, Michigan, is Rick Klein, reporter with the Boston Globe, traveling with the Bush campaign. Rick, good to have you.
Glad to be here.
Tim, give us a sense of John Kerry's campaign message, his entourage, the thrust of what he's doing as he hits the battleground states these last several days.
Sure. The message is pretty simple. It's sort of a two-pronged thing. Bush has made the country less safe than it ought to be because of his actions in Iraq, and he has failed to understand the economic problems in the country and, as a result, isn't able to fix them or address them.
And what's your sense, Tim, of exactly how John Kerry is picking his targets? It's just a handful of days now. There's only so many hours in a day. How's he deciding where to go?
It really does seem to be sort of a day-to-day thing. They've got today planned out. Obviously, we're coming to the end of that. Tomorrow we'll be in Ohio, then Florida, and then there's a big blank on the schedule that we get after that. So I think they're sort of furiously comparing notes and trying to figure out where they go next. There are a whole lot of targets. Some, you know, as far away as Hawaii, which is a place clearly we're not going to go because it takes too much time. But there are a lot of targets on the map, and they're trying to figure out how to make that map, the mass of the map, work for them.
Hawaii, very surprisingly, perhaps in play, a pink state at the moment, or purple, depending what you call it, traditionally Democrat, and right now maybe up in the air. Rick Klein, how about the Bush camp and the Bush message? Is it changing? When he goes to a tiny town like Cuba City, Wisconsin, is it the same message that he gives in a big city?
It is essentially the same message, and it really hasn't changed much over the last few months, except to occasionally respond to something that John Kerry has said. Today was the first time that he addressed the issue of the missing explosives from Iraq, and basically his response was, "We don't know what's happened to them, and it's irresponsible of John Kerry to suggest that." He said that means that he's unqualified to be commander in chief. In terms of the states that he's visiting, we're seeing a lot of the Upper Midwest states, a lot of Wisconsin, a lot of Michigan and Iowa, and the big three, obviously, of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida are the ones that I think you're going to see the most play from both camps in the closing days.
And, Rick, when President Bush goes into these smaller communities, is his campaign still requiring the kind of pledge of support from audience members before they can come into the hall? Is it a pre-screened audience even in smaller towns?
Yes. He only speaks to some level of pre-screening. You know, sometimes they aren't as explicit as pledges, but they are ticketed often by the local Republican Party. So they'll make sure that the tickets are only going to people who they know to be supportive. And it's very, very rare, and it's been only a couple of times in the 3 months or so I've been traveling with him that I've seen a heckler or a protester actually make his or her way into the place where the president is speaking. And invariably, that person is hustled out by the Secret Service when they considered anything of a security threat when someone's yelling back at the president.
And Tim Grieve, what about the mood at the Kerry events that you're seeing? How's the candidate look, and how are the crowds responding?
It's really interesting. It's really an event by event sort of thing. Tonight we're in Cedar Rapids, where Kerry has just done a rally. He got a huge sort of rock star response. In fact, he was introduced by John Bon Jovi, so he got a real rock star response. A couple of nights ago, we were in Las Vegas, and it was so flat. One reporter who'd covered an earlier campaign told me it reminded him of a Dukakis event. So it really depends on where we are, and a little bit on how Kerry is. he's a little bit up and down as well. He seems to really come alive in these early evening events, and it's a very sort of charged convention-like atmosphere at those events.
And what about the munitions story, the 380 tons of very high explosives the kind terrorists would love to have that have disappeared from the ammo dump in Iraq? What's your sense of why John Kerry is leaning so hard on that story?
Oh, it's the perfect story for them, and I don't think they're thrilled that the munitions are loose, but they're sure thrilled to have that story. It illustrates something in a very concrete way that Kerry has been saying all along, and that is that the war in Iraq has made the country less safe. And at these rallies, when Kerry says, you know, there are 380 tons of explosives that were there before and they're gone now and they could be used to blow up our buildings and our airplanes, you really do get the sense that people are kind of looking up at the sky and seeing what's coming in. It's very effective and people take it very seriously.
And Rick Klein, how about George Bush and his response there? I mean, part of it is just that Kerry has the president responding in kind of a defensive way, but also, I mean, the polls say that we really cannot tell who's going to win this vote. The president probably didn't expect to find himself in this situation. Between this story that's got him slightly back on his heels and the very close polls, how does he seem to be responding to it personally? Can you read him at all?
Well, I think the campaign and the president himself have adopted a couple of different responses to this particular story. I think they were really hoping it would go away, frankly, early on, and were sort of kind of poo-pooing its import off the bat, kind of chalking it up to the liberal media's attempt to take down a Republican president. I think, though, they realized, as John Kerry continued his attacks on this front, that it had the possibility of being a last-minute surprise that really affected the polls, because, like you say, it's so close. So I think what they did as a result of that was today they've had the president for the first time directly respond to it and really come out lashing away at John Kerry, saying that that John Kerry is denigrating the service of the troops before he knows the particulars, because no one knows, and the administration will admit it, the White House will admit, they don't even know what's happened to these weapons at this point. They don't know who has them, where they are.
And we can really hear that you're in the field there, a little wind blowing through. But Tim Grieve, what about the pitfall, potential pitfall here, that John Kerry may be seen as the Bush camp as saying denigrating the troops?
Kerry responded very forcefully to that today. He said that he's not denigrating the troops. The way you honor the troops is you do what you can do to make them safe. And if the president and his lack of planning let those weapons loose, then he failed at that test. The Kerry people also think that, you know, the central point of this thing isn't in dispute. The munitions were there. The munitions are now gone. The munitions when Saddam Hussein was in control and there was a regime of inspections were kept in check, and now God knows where they are. That's sort of the central fact for the Kerry campaign, and I think the administration has had a hard time suggesting that that's really in dispute.
Well, many miles to travel in the battleground states before Tuesday's voting. Tim Grieve with the Kerry campaign in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks a lot.
And Rick Klein with the Boston Globe with the Bush campaign in Pontiac, Michigan tonight. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So here we are, with the election less than a week away. We are looking tonight into the battleground states to see who's winning, where it counts, in the final days of the campaign. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you in the bullseye for home stretch campaigning in a battleground state? In Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Ohio, are you feeling overwhelmed with the tension? Who's winning your state, your town, your heart and mind, and how are they doing it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Mitch Frank, a reporter with Time Magazine covering the 2004 election. Mitch, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Mitch, you've been looking at the numbers and exactly how the battleground state array is breaking down. What's most hotly contested now? What's surprising? Give us a kind of survey of the field. What are these candidates looking at when they look out on the swing states?
Well, what they're looking at is really a map that has, if anything, grown bigger, not smaller. We really had expected coming down in the final month, especially after the debates, the candidates would start looking at less and less states, and they'd have to focus on just a handful that could still swing either one way or the other. And in fact, a few weeks ago, we were saying, okay, they're pulling their money out of this state and that state, and that's changing now. We have new states coming into play where the numbers are pretty tight, and in the big battlegrounds, things are just as close. They're all within the margin of error in a lot of key states, including the big three of Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania.
So those are the big ones in the middle of the bullseye here. Then give us the others that everyone's known would be swing states that surround that big three.
Well, other than that big three, we're looking at probably in the next closest are the upper Midwest states, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota, that your two correspondents were talking about there. These are really states where the rural voters moving away from the Democratic Party and more towards the Republicans, voting more along cultural issues than economics. That has really moved them more and more, and for the first time it looks like the president could pick off Wisconsin and Minnesota, which would be a big surprise. The latest polls there have Bush up in Wisconsin by a point or two. In Iowa he's up by a couple points, and Minnesota's a dead split.
So does that mean that the president, or for that matter John Kerry, if they went the other way, can they afford to lose one of these big core swing states, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and still make it up on the rebound in this next tier of swing states?
Well, that is part of the strategy. Obviously, both of the candidates would like to win all three of those big three. That would pretty much be a slam dunk, although there's obviously lots of possibilities, as we learned 4 years ago. If Bush was able to pick up Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota, he would kind of undo any damage if he had lost out on Ohio, which has become very close. And if he also loses Pennsylvania, which is one of the only states out of the big three that's kind of moving in Kerry's direction. It's moved. He's up by 4 points in the latest polls.
And what about the other two big ones, Ohio and Florida? How do they look now in the tracking polls?
They are still dead even. Kerry was pulling ahead in Ohio, but there are some polls that show him still behind. Florida, it's just as close. And you're talking about 2% here usually. It's really come down to the margin of error. And that means that what will be most crucial is turnout. All these polls kind of lose their usefulness at this point because they all have to determine, who's going to actually be a voter on Election Day? Who's going to show up? And as we've seen, there have been all these voter registration drives, all these efforts to get out the vote that are going to come to a crescendo in the next 6 days. So this is, really going to come down to which side is more motivated.
Incredible numbers. Nearly 750,000 people, new registrations to vote in Ohio this year, bringing overall registration there to 7.8 million, a record. What about that next tier? You were describing surprising states that are still in play, and I guess those that we've known but don't have as many electoral votes like New Mexico, perhaps. What's in the outer tier of the bullseye here?
Well, yeah, you mentioned New Mexico, and that's kind of the next step down, along with some of the other western states like Nevada and Colorado and also New Hampshire. And then you get kind of these wild card states. Now, two of them, West Virginia and Arkansas, the Kerry campaign had given up on. Arkansas, they kind of pulled out this summer. It was the last state other than Florida in the South that the Democrats thought they had a shot at, and the numbers just weren't looking good. Former President Clinton has been pretty outspoken that don't give up on Arkansas yet. And there was a poll a couple weeks ago that showed it a dead even race. So it's possible that the Democrats are going to spend some money there. West Virginia also a little surprisingly close. That had thought to be far outside Kerry's range. On the other side, now you have Hawaii and New Jersey. Hawaii, which hasn't gone Republican in the past 50 years, except in landslides by President Nixon and President Reagan seeking re-election. And it really would be a surprise, but we had two polls in the past week that put it pretty close. So the Democratic Party is going to be spending some money there, also some 527s like MoveOn.org. And then New Jersey also, Kerry still has a 4-point lead there, but that's a state that Gore won by double digits. So there's some speculation. We're not sure why. Maybe because so many people in New Jersey were so close to 9/11 that they have moved towards the president.
So are you toting up electoral votes at this point and making a projection, or is that still just entirely impossible?
Well, it's pretty impossible. I mean, there are lots of sites that locked on the web and lots of publications that like to speculate on it every day in the tracking polls. But when you get down to the fact that the big three and then another six or seven states are complete toss-ups, makes it pretty hard to guess. I know that some papers were even speculating today about the possibility of a 269 to 269 vote tie.
Right. Many ways of making that happen. Mitch Frank, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the final push for votes in the battleground states. You can join us. Are you in the bullseye of the home stretch battleground campaign? Are you being bombarded in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Ohio? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the final push for the battleground states and what it tells us about who is likely to come out ahead next Tuesday. Here's President Bush on the campaign trail earlier today in Lititz, Pennsylvania.
Americans have seen how I do my job. Even when you might not agree with me, you know what I believe and where I stand and where I intend to lead our country.
That was President Bush in Pennsylvania earlier today. Here is Senator John Kerry at a rally in Sioux City, Iowa.
I will never stop fighting to bring back hope for the millions of hardworking Americans who believe in their hearts that tomorrow can be better than today. That's what this is about.
Senator John Kerry in Iowa, you can join us tonight. Are you in a battleground bullseye tonight, or are you feeling ignored in the 40 states that aren't in the swing state bullseye? What do your cousins in New Mexico tell you? What does your gut tell you? Who is winning this election? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Mitch Frank from Time Magazine, joining us from New York. Right now from Washington, D.C., we're joined as well by E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow in government studies at the Brookings Institution, author of Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. E.J. Dionne, thanks for being with us tonight.
Always good to be with you, especially since you're sitting in the heart of Red Sox Nation.
Red Sox Nation and the game just about to crank up, or maybe just about cranking up. Everybody's got their Red Sox paraphernalia on. I can guarantee you that tonight,
EJ.
I think
it's turning on after your show is over.
Right. Oh, well, okay. It's coming. We know it's coming. And with us from Stanford, California, David Brady, deputy director and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, co-author of Revolving Gridlock, Politics and Policy from Carter to Clinton. David Brady, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
EJ, let me go first to you and this battleground subject. We've been talking about it for months, but now it really is kind of the whole shooting match, as they say. I mean, you win the battleground and you win next Tuesday.
Right, and then you just got to decide which battleground you could win. I mean, if any lover of board games would love to be in the situation of these campaigns, because you have a limited amount of money. They've spent a lot of their money, and they've got to make some bets in the last several days of the campaign about which of these states are their best option. And do you take a flyer on states that are coming into play, like Arkansas, as has been mentioned? If you do that, do you take money out of some other state? Which state? So it's a fascinating technical problem. I have this sense that Republicans are very, very uneasy about Ohio. I've talked to a lot of these folks over the last few days, and they are starting to build a scenario that Bush can win without Ohio, which says they feel they're in trouble there. And they are looking very much to those upper Midwest states. I think Democrats think that winning Iowa is going to be very difficult, but they want to hang on to Wisconsin and Minnesota. The sense I have is there is a very, very, very slight breeze at Kerry's back for two reasons. One is that the states that seem to be opening up now, with the exception of Hawaii, imagine on election night having us all in the mainland United States waiting for the Hawaii vote.
Till the next morning, practically.
Yes, exactly. But for the most part, the states that seem to be opening up are states we thought were Bush states, Arkansas, Virginia, possibly West Virginia. The second reason is that this munitions story has really thrown the Bush campaign and the Bush forces on the defensive. I was driving up to Reading, Pennsylvania yesterday to hear John Edwards speak at a rally, and I was listening to Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh had to spend a lot of time on his show fighting these allegations, saying they were wrong, they aren't true. Rush Limbaugh would much rather be on the offensive than the defensive. and so would President Bush.
But 380 tons of explosive have got them perhaps in a different theme, at least for a while. David Brady, how are you seeing this quite varied picture? A lot of battleground states, as Mitch Frank and E.J. Dionne are telling us tonight. It's all about the combinations that people win. E.J. Dionne sees, as he describes it, a very slight breeze it carries back tonight. How do you interpret that complicated board game?
Well, we picked up over the weekend the same little breeze. It's a very little breeze, but in a really close election, that's all you need. So we picked up a little motion toward Kerry, and that does change the game for Bush. Ohio is not looking as good as it used to be, and so that means that probably the president's going to have to spend more time in Iowa and Wisconsin and some in Minnesota. That's time he can't spend in Ohio, given a limited amount of time. In one sense, part of the board game is forcing the candidate to go to places that they don't that they'd like not to go to, and frankly, I think there's a little bit more pressure on Bush now to move to those states and spend more time there than there is on Kerry. I think Pennsylvania is sort of tipped to Kerry now. I don't think he has to worry about it. I don't think Bush can take it. And so, again, that makes the board game fairly interesting.
Now, David Brady, explain to us how this works. We see on Tuesday afternoon a driving rainstorm in the Wisconsin town of Cuba City, 2,047 residents, and President Bush spends most of a better part of the afternoon there. What is the calculus that makes a sitting president think that it's worth his time to spend that much time in the soaking rain in Cuba City, Wisconsin, when the whole nation is getting ready to vote?
Well, by and large, because he's getting in a close state like that, by and large, he's getting press coverage, and the press coverage is bumping their print percentage of the vote up 0.5% to 3/4. And so it's all set up so that the local press, local in the rural areas there, is picking it up. And so they're picking up, they view publicity and crucial votes in close states.
So it's about the coverage. Mitch Frank, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's EJ here.
Oh, EJ,
I wanted to say that Bush has a perfectly rational strategy, and Ron Brownstein wrote about this in the L.A. Times today, that the Bush campaign is very focused on rural areas and, for lack of a better term, exurban or new suburban areas. In 2000, Al Gore didn't win the election. I'll never say Al Gore lost the election, given my views on what the Supreme Court did, because there was this surge toward the Republicans in rural America.
Right.
And part of what Bush is doing, the reason he goes to a place like Cuba City, is he is really trying to drive up the Republican vote in rural areas. He's also going to sort of far suburbs. He doesn't go to the central city. He goes to these far suburbs because he and Karl Rove think that is where the potential Republican vote is. And I think from their point of view, the Republicans' point of view, it's a reasonably rational strategy, even though it's surprising to us that people go to Cuba City instead of one of the big cities.
But, EJ, let me ask you about that upper Midwest rural vote. Is it does it fit the same cookie cutter as the rural vote in the rest of the country? I've seen some analysis here saying that it doesn't line up as neatly with the GOP agenda, perhaps, as the rural vote in so much of the rest of the country.
Well, on balance, the rural America tipped Republican in the late 90s to a degree it hadn't before. But also we have to remember that this economic recovery, such as it has been very uneven. One of the reasons the president is in trouble in Ohio is because Ohio has been really hammered with the loss of manufacturing jobs. On the other hand, Iowa is doing rather well, and for a small government president, the farm program has poured an awful lot of federal dollars into Iowa. So I think some of this differentiation among states really is about how this economy has affected them. And Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota have done better than Ohio and Pennsylvania.
So, Mitch Frank, if it comes to that, and what we're hearing is Pennsylvania maybe leaning, maybe going Kerry, Ohio, Bush, folks not feeling so great about, that really does put a lot of importance on Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota. What do you see in the tracking polls there?
Well, yeah, I would echo EJ a little bit on that, in the fact that, like Iowa, Wisconsin has had a much better economy in the past 4 years. focusing on small-scale manufacturing as opposed to Ohio and Michigan, places where they're still struggling with manufacturing. And it's also, you know, Wisconsin has always been different. Rural voters there went more for Gore than for Bush 4 years ago, which made it one of the few states where that was true, just because it has such a long tradition of winning progressive votes. But that seems to be changing. Wisconsin and Minnesota may be the last places where rural voters vote Democratic, and they seem to be changing more and more to the GOP side. And the tracking polls back that up. They really show that, you know, Minnesota has been a dead split for a while. Bush has enjoyed anywhere from a 1 to 2% lead in the past couple of weeks in Wisconsin. It was even bigger before then. Kerry hasn't been able to take the lead. And Iowa, yeah, that's a dead split going 1 to 3% for Bush right now. So really, that is the president's contingency strategy if he loses Ohio, which it's looking like he may very well. And it would be a big loss for Kerry and for the Democrats in general, who have kind of counted on the Midwest to counter the South that they've lost completely.
Let's get a call from that part of the country. Kim is calling from Mesomany, Wisconsin, right up the road from Cuba City, where the president appeared this week. Kim, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? What's happening on your block tonight?
Hi there.
Hi.
Can you hear me all right?
Just fine.
Okay, this is Paulette Kim, T-I-M-M. I live in rural Mesomany. I live not too far from Cuba City in Richland Center, where the president was yesterday. And I know several of the people that were all lining the roads. They were all Kerry Edwards signs all the way. There were no Bush Cheney signs being held by people. There are signs along the road. Of course, all the Kerry signs were all taken down the night before, systematically.
Taken down by whom, Paulette?
Oh, we don't know. And it was done very organized, systematic fashion the night before. Before Bush came through Spring Green onto Cuba City.
So Paulette, are you giving us your fully straightforward journalistic interpretation of what's going on there? Or are you giving us a partisan interpretation?
No, well, actually, it's probably both, but this is actually very factual. I've seen it with my own eyes. I'm a sort of a disabled person. I'm not able to get out everywhere and go in big crowds, but I did survey the area myself because I live right here. And I am involved in politics for the first time in my life. I'm 65. I'm a retired educator. And I am appalled at the way this president is taking this country. I have never seen it like this.
And your sense is that in your neck of the woods, as you interpret it, it's Kerry country, even though the president was just there on Tuesday.
Listen, these people have lost their jobs. The big Bradley company in Richland Center, they're all out of work. They weren't invited. The people around here don't appreciate having the president come and then have it be invitation only. We're not that style of people in this part of the world. We believe in a free democracy and free association, and that was a real downer. And it's well known that that was an invitation-only affair.
Well, there's a boo hiss from up the road from Cuba City. Let's hear from a reporter who's been working this area in Wisconsin. We're joined right now by Dee Hall. She's a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal in Madison, Wisconsin. Dee, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Nice to meet you.
It's great to have you. You've been out on the hustings. You've been watching these candidates work their throats hoarse and their staffs to distraction all hours of the day in Wisconsin. What are you seeing? What are you hearing?
Well, in our part of the state, in Madison, we are very obviously a progressive stronghold and have been for a long time and went heavily for Gore in 2000. We are seeing the candidates come every day or so. Either a candidate or a candidate's wife has been here every day for the past 2 to 3 weeks, and it's almost impossible to keep up with the visits. The Kerry events tend to be somewhat larger, although I think the caller earlier mentioned the invitation-only nature of the Bush events. Mm-hmm. We are seeing that even in the very largest events that the president has had. I was covering his bus tour of Western Wisconsin yesterday, the one she was referring to, and there was a little bit of a controversy about the fact that the students were told not to wear anti-Bush or pro-Kerry T-shirts into the talk in Richland Center. I guess it's hard to say from here which way it's going to go. The polls are dead even. you know, both candidates are drawing pretty large crowds. There are in the neighborhood, there are tens of thousands of volunteers that are being claimed by both sides, and it's just too close to call, I think.
So presumably in Wisconsin, the Democratic candidate has to get Madison and Milwaukee. The Republican goes for the suburbs and the rural vote. Is that how it's breaking down?
Yes, exactly. In 2000, Madison went for Gore by 61% about 33%. I'm sorry, for Bush. And Milwaukee County was 58% for Gore, 38% for Bush. But then you go right over the line in Waukesha in suburban Milwaukee County, and they were 65% for Bush, 32% for Gore. So we do have some deep red and deep blue areas of the state. And so really, the president needs to do well outside of the two major cities, which I think, you know, those are pretty much a loss for him.
Dee, when you walk through the crowds at the Bush event, how do you hear them responding to the president's messages, his themes?
Well, it's interesting. His theme yesterday was the economy, but there were very few people who were really supporting the president based on his economic policies. A lot of them were very much, there's a lot of fear. They fear that if we don't reelect President Bush, that the country will face more attacks, that we will have in John Kerry somebody who isn't willing to take the initiative. And then there were a lot of single-issue people there yesterday whom I talked to, for whom abortion, for example, was a major major issue.
So those values issues sitting right there. Dee Hall in Madison, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Let's take a call. Danny is calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're in a swing state. Danny, how's it look there?
Well, I must say that, first of all, I want to tell you guys that you're doing a great job. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. How do you see it?
Very interesting conversation going on. But what I want to say, I want to share something with you that you might not agree with me. But before to answer your question, I think that the president is doing very well. Around Pittsburgh area, at least it's the way that I see it, because I think within the last 2 days, most of the people that I speak to, and they have been undecided voters, you know, they see that the president is more believable and is more focused on what he wants to say. So I feel that there is a change going towards the president. But that being said and done, when I hear that this is going to be very close, I don't know how that could be very close, because if you take a look at the numbers, the Electoral College numbers, you see that in either way, the president is going to win. And I would like to share that with you.
Well, there's a lot of ways to slice those numbers, but we hear it sounds like you're leaning to the president there in Pittsburgh, Danny, and thanks for your call. Mitch Frank, I know we've got to let you go in a minute here, but the Pennsylvania call, as we're hearing it tonight, seems to be trending Kerry, but not necessarily in Danny's neck of Pittsburgh.
Well, it's certainly still within the margin of error, and there's certainly enough time for things to change. Pennsylvania, you know, it's the president spent a lot of time there in the past 4 years. He's made over 40 visits because he was really disappointed that he lost the state last time. You're really talking about a state that splits up into three chunks. Philadelphia, the city itself, is going to go overwhelmingly for Kerry. It's basically part of the liberal Northeast, and they've registered a lot of new voters there. So Kerry is going to try to get a huge turnout to kind of compensate for some of the more conservative parts, including the Philadelphia suburbs, where the president has had some success in the past. Pittsburgh itself is pretty Democratic, but the suburbs are more Republican and more Midwestern. And then the center of the state can be rural and quite conservative.
So we divide it and we subdivide it. We're going to take a short break. And, Mitch, I know we have to let you go, but thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Mitch Frank with Time Magazine. E.J. Dionne and David Brady, please stand by. We are talking about the final push for votes in the battleground states and what it tells us about who is likely to win the White House next Tuesday. Who's got the momentum where it most counts? What do you see? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the final push for votes in the battleground states. It's where the election's going to be decided. There are a few more of them than people expected some weeks ago, as you've heard tonight. You can join our conversation. What do you think of the final stretch themes of Bush and Kerry? Are they working? Have you seen the president and the senator working the back roads, scraping for every vote? 6 days from that vote, can you see a winner emerging tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Speaking of winners, Red Sox up one in St. Louis right now in that World Series contest. Lorraine is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Lorraine. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm disappointed that North Carolina is not considered a battleground state. From what I perceive here in the Capitol, support seems overwhelmingly to be in favor of John Kerry. Not to mention it's the city John Edwards calls home. I could be falsely celebratory regarding North Carolina's support for Democrats just from what I see here in Raleigh. However, I'm also feeling positive that our rural counties will be in favor for the Democrats due to the fact that North Carolina has suffered economically due to job outsourcing in the textile industry, for example. And I know that our economy suffered terribly after 9/11.
So it's feeling Kerry Edwards to you, Lorraine. Thanks for calling. We've got David Brady at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University with us and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. David Brady, what about North Carolina? Is it a settled state?
I don't think that, no, it looks to me like it's going to go for Bush, and it actually looks as though the Republicans going to win the Senate seat. I mean, it's still, quote, within the margin of error, but let me say that the margin of error on these polls with the turndown rates and the problems with the polls in this election, margin of error is not very meaningful.
And turndown rates meaning people that the pollsters call who just refuse to cooperate?
Not cooperating, not answering the phone. And there's another, as they get to the end on these polls, you know, of course, they don't really have polls of registered voters. They have random digit dialing by area code and demographic characteristic. And so they try to ask a set of code questions to see if you are likely to vote. And those questions are not working as well as they did in the past. So they tend to even further exacerbate day-by-day perturbation. So if Kerry's had a good day, he's up by more. If Bush has a good day, he's up by more. And they don't reflect the underlying distribution.
E.J. Dionne, on North Carolina for a moment, of course, as Lorraine points out, it's John Edwards' state. If he doesn't bring it in for John Kerry, how are the Democrats going to interpret his choice as a vice presidential running mate?
Well, I don't think he was put on the ticket to Kerry, North Carolina. Democrats hope they might have a chance there. And I think in the long haul, North Carolina could become a Democratic state. It's changing. A lot of people are moving into that Research Triangle area. I think 10 years from now, it will be a very competitive state. I think John Edwards' job was, A, to make a case and appeal to voters who are fundamentally Southern in certain ways, like in Southern Ohio. And if Southern Ohio comes in with decent numbers, people will say John Edwards may have helped there. I want to go back to the caller from Wisconsin and cheer her for a point she made. I do think there's something very disconcerting, excuse me, I got a cold, about the way in which the Bush campaign has decided to exclude everyone. If you show up at a Bush event with a Kerry T-shirt on, you are escorted by the forces of the law. That doesn't seem an appropriate use of either the Secret Service or the police. And I think that's a very disconcerting message the president is sending. He can tolerate some people at his rallies wearing a Kerry T-shirt. I just find that a very disconcerting thing. And I think it's this. I think you saw that in the first debate where the president was not accustomed to facing challenge and opposition. And when he was confronted by Kerry with some tough arguments, he didn't do very well. He got better in the other two debates. But I think that's something, I hope we don't have a campaign like that again, where one side absolutely excludes undecided or opposition people from their rallies. Good politicians have used hecklers to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say I don't, that's way, in my view, way over-interpreting. Fact is that given the press coverage the president has been getting, it's pretty clear that from their viewpoint, they don't want to get hecklers in there, and that'd cause a problem. I don't know what the overall implications for democracy are, but they're certainly not very much. I just don't see it as a problem.
You don't see having communication. Yeah.
Using cops and Secret Service people to escort people out is using the power of government against people who dissent, and I don't think that's appropriate.
David Brady?
I don't. First of all, I don't know what's happening.
That's true.
That's where it's happening, and I don't know how it's happening. So I'd have to know more before I could make all those points.
I guess I'm just looking here at a story from the Des Moines Register, one of a number of stories we've seen, but this is quoting a high school senior in Clive, Iowa, when the president was there, who was talking to the Des Moines Register about what an intimidating environment it was. He said that some security guy came back and said, if you protest, it won't be me taking you out, as in out of this auditorium. It will be a sniper. Now, that's not, of course, you know, that, it's over the top, but this isn't exactly a welcoming atmosphere as described in the Des Moines Register anyway. Let's get another call. Anita's calling from Spooner, Wisconsin. Hi, Anita, you're on the air.
Hi. Here's my comment. I do a lot of, own a small business in Spooner, which is about 3 hours east of the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and probably 4 hours northeast of Madison.
How's it look there, Anita?
Pardon?
How's it look there?
Well, I would have to say that from the signs, it looks pretty equal. But I would say Bush is really making a push. I mean, the NRA is doing a great job in this part of the country to really ramp up the votes for Bush by stating, you know, Kerry's voting record on you know, hunting rifles, and I don't know if it's misconstrued or not at this point.
You don't think John Kerry's goose hunting expedition managed to push that back?
No, I don't think it has. I know that because the guy that shares a office next to mine, Dale the Barber, had me make some copies of Bush Kerry's voting record on hunting rifles, and you know, so he's voting for Bush. But the other thing I wanted to mention is I just want to mention this as well, that it was very interesting to me that the Catholic Church is also, and I'm sure other churches as well, they actually are handing out brochures at church, and on the outside it looks very equal, but they're having little you know, love fests afterwards in support of George Bush. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens. But, you know, I still think that there's some equality here. From what I could see, there's lots of Kerry signs out there.
So neck and neck, it sounds like maybe leaning Bush. David Brady, we just got a couple minutes remaining here. You spend a lot of time watching these things unfold. What are you going to be looking for in the next couple of days as we go through this weekend to point your antenna toward Kerry or Bush in the victory column?
I'm looking for trying to look at as many polls say in those key states as possible. So, for example, if you looked at the Florida polls, while a lot of these people keep a running average, the Florida poll, the last Florida poll that was included last weekend, was the first that showed Kerry ahead. So I'm trying to look at the latest polls, as many as I can, state by state. I'm adding them up to try and get the N up and sort of get a guess. Early on, I think EJ said that there was a little breeze toward Kerry, and it looked like there was over the weekend. So that's what I'm looking for, to see if that's continuing.
And E.J. Dionne, how volatile do you think this will remain right up to election day? Are we essentially in the groove that we're going to be in on November 2nd, or could something still mix it up significantly?
Well, I am looking for what trash will come out against either candidate in the media in the final days of the campaign. And, you know, I hope it doesn't happen, but I think you could have, you already have efforts to put something negative about one guy or the other in the wind, and I think that could affect the campaign. The most interesting observation I heard today came from a Republican pollster who said that if the turnout is up but only to about 110 million in the country, the Bush people feel pretty good. If the turnout gets to 120 million, they feel very alarmed. I think a lot of it will depend on these efforts that Democrats and allied groups have made to register new voters and get them to the polls. If you have a very high turnout, an exceptional turnout, I think Kerry wins.
And there we may see all those legions of lawyers come in into play as voters get challenged and all the rest. E.J. Dionne, always wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, and go Sox.
E.J. Dionne at the Washington Post and David Brady at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good to have you on board.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a voter in a non-battleground state clamors for attention. This is On Point. With all of the attention being paid to voters in Florida and Ohio and Wisconsin and the rest of the year's swing states, some in the non-battleground states are left to wonder if their votes really matter. While the nation holds its breath to see if Iowa turns red or blue, there will be little drama in Wyoming, where George Bush holds a 36-point lead, or in Washington, D.C., where John Kerry leads by 67 points. Massachusetts resident Michael Obel Amia is frustrated that neither campaign has paid much attention to him or his fellow residents in his very blue state. In this radio diary, he says the only thing bringing him to the polls on Tuesday is a sense of sacred responsibility.
Election day is almost here, but I'm not nearly as excited about voting as I have been for the past 20 years. Like millions of other Americans, I have been ignored these past 8 weeks because I don't live in a battleground state. While both campaigns are spending as much as $4 million a day wooing voters elsewhere, I've hardly seen or heard any political ads. I don't need to be wooed, but I do need to be informed. Ignored and seemingly powerless, I shall cast my vote on Tuesday, nevertheless. I vote because it's my responsibility as a citizen and my honor as an African American. I have read American history, and I praise those men and women who sacrificed their safety and their lives to ensure my freedom and my right to vote. The least that I can do to thank and honor them is to cast my ballot. Voting is my opportunity to say something. As Malcolm X noted, if you are not a part of the solution, then you are a part of the problem. Massachusetts hasn't always been the hinterlands for this election. The Democrats hosted their convention in Boston over the summer. Elated, I watched the convention and was swept up in the pomp and pageantry of the event. But then the lights dimmed, the bunting sagged, the balloons limped to the floor, and I wondered where the Democratic Party had gone. Abandoned, in August I gleefully tuned into the Republican convention held in New York, eager to hear positions defined and solutions proffered. That convention held my attention and encouraged my participation in the process. But again, the lights dimmed, the bunting sagged, and both camps effectively retreated from the Northeast. My only connection to this election now is the occasional email that asks for my financial support, but neglects to inform me or engage me in a meaningful discussion. As with most of my fellow Americans, my vote has been taken for granted. I live in Massachusetts, hence it is assumed that I shall be voting for John Kerry. Despite how I am being treated by both parties, I am still deeply interested in and committed to this election, and more important, this country's future. I could protest and refuse to vote, but I won't. This decision is too important. I don't like feeling so small, so insignificant, so powerless, because our future, my future, depends so much on this election. And I don't feel as if anyone is listening to me or representing my positions. Almost 45% of the electorate may refuse to participate in the most important exercise that we can do as citizens. Just because the candidates are missing an opportunity to engage people in the democratic process, that doesn't excuse our neglecting our duty to make our voices heard and our concerns known. This kind of abuse by the candidates, using polls to determine where they should spend their money and time, will inflict great damage on our democracy and our future, but not as much damage as our apathetic response. I shall go to the polls with Franklin Roosevelt's words. Let us never forget that government is ourselves and not an alien power over us. The ultimate rulers of our democracy are not a president and senators and congressmen and government officials, but the voters of this country.
Michael Obel Amia teaches English at the Roxbury Latin School in Boston. He lives in Needham, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.